Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us on Human Rights Demand. This is Human Rights Demand broadcast for September 14th, 2014. We really appreciate your joining us today. This is a very special broadcast because we're going to talk with my mother, Hattie Neal. We're going to talk to Hattie Neal. She was a plaintiff in the Neals versus the Cochran firm lawsuits. Those were two lawsuits against the Jenny Cochran firm for defrauding the Neal family when Larry Neal, my mentally and physically disabled brother, was secretly arrested and murdered in Memphis Shelby County Jail in 2003. The Jenny Cochran firm defrauded my family, never did investigate the case or file any lawsuits in the matter whatsoever, never intended to. The whole thing was a sham from beginning to end. While we waited for the legal action to go forward, they were doing nothing but holding the case secretly inactive, secretly inactive. And so now it's 11 years later, and my mother and I have no idea why that lawsuit did not go through except for fraud, absolute fraud. The managing partner of the Jenny Cochran firm was himself a county commissioner for Shelby County. He was the longest standing county commissioner for Shelby County. As a matter of fact, Julian Bolton had stepped down from being Shelby County's commissioner's chairman. He had stepped down from the chairmanship in order to help Jenny Cochran start the Jenny Cochran Law Firm in Memphis. When it started, Julian Bolton was appointed the lead partner of that operation. Imagine that. The lead partner of the Jenny Cochran firm was himself the chairman of the Shelby County Commission, and the Shelby County Commission owns and operates Shelby County Jail, where Larry Neal was placed in secret arrest and murdered in 2003. The Jenny Cochran firm did not bring that lawsuit. It never intended to. I discovered that definitely when I received an affidavit from a man in Memphis who had gone to the Jenny Cochran firm for representation against the Shelby County Jail when he was terminated there. He endured wrongful termination, and he went to the Jenny Cochran firm for legal representation. The Jenny Cochran firm told this man in writing that it could not represent him against Shelby County Jail because it had a conflict of interest in doing so. Its lead partner was an officer of that jail. They told this man right away that they had a conflict representing anyone against Shelby County Jail. But they did not tell the Neal family, because the intention from the initial phone call where we called the Cochran firm in Atlanta, the initial intention was, and it remained, to defraud the Neal family on behalf of Shelby County Jail. That was the intention, and that is what was done. However, when the statute of limitations was ending on the Neals versus the Cochran firm lawsuit, I wrote to the Cochran firm and inquired why nobody in my family had been contacted to give depositions regarding the Cochran firm's case with the Neal family. The contract had been signed. Most of the statute of limitations had passed. I trusted the law firm that it was doing the other things that it wrote us and told us it was doing. For instance, it said that it was conducting deposition testimony, collecting deposition testimony from other people who were incarcerated with Larry Neal. The Cochran firm said that it was getting records from Shelby County Jail and depositions from jailers there. The Cochran firm said that they were getting Larry's medical records from his 20 years in a psychiatric hospital, Western State Mental Hospital in Bolivar, Tennessee, and his 20 years of records from Tennessee Psychiatric Hospital there in Memphis, and his many, many medical records from medical hospitals in Memphis, where he had been an inpatient for conditions that were caused by his mental illness, pneumonia several times, because Larry Neal did not know how to dress adequately for the weather. He would go out into bad weather with nothing on but a hospital gown and paper slippers, weather that was below freezing. So they were gathering all those records and getting depositions from other parties, we were led to believe. However, when I wrote to the Cochran firm and asked why no deposition testimony had been taken from anyone in my family yet, we only had about 6 weeks left on the statute of limitations. And that's when David wrote back and said, we haven't done anything about suing Shelby County Jail yet because our lead attorney, Julian Bolton, is an officer over Shelby County Jail, and we were concerned that we might have a conflict of interest. This is almost 12 months after they had sworn to us that they had no conflict of interest. When they did their conflict of interest check, they had already sworn to us they had no conflict of interest and could accept that case and called us in for signing contract. Almost 12 months later, this man, David McLaughlin, a super lawyer. Be careful of these lawyers listed as super lawyers and getting awards. The Cochran firm is always getting awards. They don't tell you about the many, many, many lawsuits against that law firm by its previous clients. They do not publish them in regular media. They're only published in law journals. But I pulled them forward for you so that you can read about the lawsuits against the Cochran firm by its former clients, its former attorneys, its former partners, and other law firms that it partners with on certain cases. All of those parties have sued the Cochran firm, calling it racist and calling it fraudulent and complaining that it did malpractice. In fact, its former attorney, one of its former attorneys, sued and said in an interview with NPR that she and other of Johnny Cochran's lawyers were let go after he died or forced out of the firm because they refused to deliver inadequate legal services to their clients. That Sean Chapman Holley, H-O-L-L-E-Y, it should be online. Controversy at the Johnny Cochran firm. That's at NPR. I want you to know that the Johnny Cochran firm is one of the law firms in America that is set up to do nothing but spy on its clients through what the clients believe are confidential conversations with one's attorney. It is one of the law firms that is dedicated to protecting the interests of the status quo. You know, I read the other day that one of the purposes of FEMA is to keep the present social order, protect the present social order. And the social order that I know is very racist. It's very racist and unfair, particularly toward people who are black, brown, poor, any of those. So that's I see it as one of the Cochran firm's missions. Johnny Cochran sold his law firm, by the way. He sold interest in it before he died. He sold interest in the Cochran firm to some people who turned out to be white supremacists, Southern white supremacists. And his firm, as far as I know, is now used to make fools of primarily black people throughout the nation. This law firm took our contract and then rendered no legal services whatsoever, but in order to prevent us from getting a lawyer who really would bring a wrongful death case and a negligence case for Larry Neal's murder, it pretended to be our attorneys and wrote us about legal work that was not really being done. Can anyone say mail fraud? But the Cochran firm got awards after that. Ever since, the Cochran firm steadily gets awards from white supremacist white supremacists. They get awards because of their scheming against African Americans. Scheming against African Americans. By the way, Shelby County Jail at that time, in 2003, was operating under an agreement with the United States of America. And the agreement that it was operating under required the jail to give monthly reports regarding the inmates that it had, any medical conditions they were being treated for, or any information at all. Especially Shelby County Jail had to file inmate fatality reports if they happen to lose any inmates. I wrote to the USDOJ, which was in overview of Shelby County Jail, and asked for a copy of the inmate fatality report regarding Larry Neal, because we didn't have it. We found out the Cochran firm had worked against us and had done no investigation, had requested no records, so I requested them. And the USDOJ claimed not to have received any information whatsoever with Larry Neal's name on it. And then, over a year later, I read that Memphis Shelby County Jail was involved in release hearings with the USA to be released from its agreement to exist under USDOJ overview. And these were public release hearings where the public was asked to give their input regarding Shelby County Jail in Memphis, its behavior during the period while it was under direct federal overview. I wrote to the judge. I wrote to the USDOJ. I wrote to its officials over Memphis Shelby County Jail. And I said to them that Memphis Shelby County Jail has a depth that have been kept out of the reports to you. And I told them about how the Jenny Cochran firm had defrauded my family to prevent a lawsuit regarding Larry Neal's secret arrest. For 18 days, they kept him secretly incarcerated, during which time we don't have any idea what was being done to this American with a mental disability. I let the officials know over that court proceeding, the release hearings for Shelby County Jail, just who they were dealing with and just how far they would go to hide a death in custody. And do you know that they went right ahead and conducted those federal hearings and ignored their correspondence with me regarding Larry Neal's murder? The USDOJ, I said, went right ahead with those release hearings, and I was told by a reporter for a public radio that she found the release for Memphis Shelby County Jail that was issued by the USA after knowing that it had hidden the murder of an American with disabilities. They wrote me back, the government, the U.S. government wrote me back and said that it still had no information regarding Larry Neal even after those release hearings, which means that it deliberately accepted lies, fraudulent documents, and information from that jail was deliberately accepted by the United States in those release hearings because they well knew what had happened. They well knew what had happened. Because they corresponded with me about it. And you can see, yes, the correspondence at Wrongful Death of Larry Neal website. The name of it is Wrongful Death of Larry Neal. That's a website that you can look at online. And you go to the Documents tab, and you will see some of the correspondence with the USA regarding the secret arrest and wrongful death of Larry Neal. I found out after that it's not at all unusual for Americans with mental disabilities to be killed even to be killed during secret arrest. It's not at all unusual. As a matter of fact, San Carlos Prison released information on a case recently, like within the last 4 weeks, where a man died in custody 17 months ago. I doubt if the USDOJ investigated that death in custody either. Our mentally disabilities, people with mental disabilities, are ordinarily shot and killed by police, with or without cause. They are ordinarily brutalized behind bars in America's jails and prisons. Many, many people with mental disabilities have been subjected to cruel and torturous incarceration, including death. We were all shocked. Well, you were shocked. I wasn't. When you read about people with mental disabilities in prison in Dade County Correctional Facility being made to fight each other like gladiators, being made to brutalize each other for the entertainment of the guards in Dade Correctional Facility. Many of you were shocked when you read about Darren Rainey being drugged into a shower with hot scalding water turned on him so high that the meat came off his muscles and he expired there screaming, I'll be good, please, I'll be good. Many of you were absolutely floored when you read about a former Marine, Jerome Murdaugh, who was baked to death in Rikers Island Jail. Unfortunately, the Cochran firm has Jerome Murdaugh's case, and they also have the case of John, the young man who was shot to death by police officers in Walmart when he was on the phone with his back turned, leaning against some type of toy, an air rifle or a BB gun that he was thinking about purchasing. He was shopping in Walmart, talking on the phone, leaning on this toy with the nozzle down, pointed toward the floor. And they just walked up and shot him dead. That was John in Walmart. The Cochran firm has that case. They also have the case of Chavis Carter, the young man who was searched twice, double handcuffed and locked into the back of an Arkansas police car. And unfortunately, the police dash cam happened to have stopped working at exactly the point that this young Houdini managed to pull out a gun that he had hidden on himself somewhere and shoot himself in the right temple, although he was left-handed. Many, many other black young men have been alleged to have Houdini powers after that. And they always cite the Chavis Carter suicide, so-called suicide, when they say that people, black people, managed to get out of handcuffs or not even get out of them. They managed to wiggle around with them on and shoot themselves in the back of police cars. They always cite the Chavis Carter suicide, that now the Cochran firm frauds are in charge of getting justice for Chavis Carter's mother. And that is because the media will not publish, they will not publish any of the Cochran firm frauds that have already happened. That is how black people keep taking their wrongful deaths to those COINTELPRO agents. and even black so-called owned media companies will not publish the Cochrane firm frauds. They love black people so much, but they won't warn grieving mothers about these agents of doom. They won't warn them that they don't really file many of their lawsuits that they get, especially lawsuits against any government agencies. They don't warn them. I want to play a little music for you, and then I want you to enjoy spending a little time with my mother, Hattie Neal. And I want to thank you all for joining us today. I'm going to play a little bit of music for you. Nina Simone, "I Wish I Knew What It Was Like to Be Free." And that is the wish of exactly 1.25 million or more mentally ill people who today are incarcerated in America, many of them in long-term solitary confinement, which is torture. The shape of the brain, the physiological shape of the brain, actually changes after a few days in solitary confinement. But this is how America's mentally ill people live day in, day out, year after year, and sometimes over decades. So enjoy this music, and we'll be right back with you.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is
Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, for holding through that station break. I hope you enjoyed Nina Simone as much as I did. Nina Simone was a great star. She was a writer, composer, and piano player. She was a great singer who lived during the Civil Rights Movement and rose to great stardom during that period. Nina Simone, according to her biographers, was also mentally ill. She had a type of bipolar disorder and was on regular medication for her condition. You see, people who have mental illness are ordinarily nonviolent, and they can live wholesome lives as long as their conditions are treated properly. But we find that in America now, that so many prison investors work in the government in various positions, so many people are deprived of psychiatric treatment. That was done when Medicaid was withdrawn from mental hospitals. That was done when the budget for community treatment was cut. And it was also done when strict rules were enforced that nobody could be enforced to accept psychiatric treatment unless they proved to be a danger to self and others. So those are three things that were done in the 60s and 70s that devastated so many families. 1.25 million mentally ill people are in jail today. 80% of the people in long-term solitary confinement are blacks. And 60% of the people experiencing prison torture, long-term solitary confinement, are mentally ill. But I promise you a great treat right now. I'm going to let you hear my mother. She's looking for something. What are you looking for, Mom?
Looking for the children. Terrible. Maybe getting my ass shut.
They're gone. They've been gone. Ryan has been gone for a long time. And Mimi and Kennedy are downstairs. She's keeping up with her grandchildren from her hospital bed in her room. Oh. Mama, say good evening to everybody.
Good evening, everybody.
I told your grandchildren and some of your children you'd be talking to them today.
Well, I don't know nothing to say.
Well, I'll ask you a few questions. Now, you are from Somerville, Tennessee. Is that right? Barbara Williams is listening, too.
I was born in Whitehaven, Tennessee, and was transferred to Somerville, Tennessee about 7 years old.
Okay.
And I spent the rest of my life there. So I came to Georgia.
Yes. And you've been in Georgia, over 25 years.
Yeah, I have.
Now, you were in Georgia when we got the call that Larry Neal was dead.
Yeah.
You recall that day?
Yeah, I do.
That was a sad day.
Yeah. Very sad. It's still sad.
Yes. And you recall that when we drove to Memphis for his funeral, the next day after his burial, I took you to the Jenny Cochran firm there in Memphis.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I just took down the information. So somebody took down the information.
I think she was a paralegal.
Young lady. Uh-huh.
Yes. She was a black young lady.
Uh-huh.
And you signed contract for them to be our lawyers.
Yes.
You know, I looked at that contract the other day, and I could see your teardrops on the contract. Do you remember when we were driving home from the Jenny Cochran firm? We saw a man in the street railing at nothing. He was fussing at nobody. And we knew he had to be either mentally ill or very drunk. And you said to me, signing that contract and getting justice for Larry might help save people like him from being killed when they go to jail. You remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember the day when we got a dismissal from court and they said there is no Cochran firm office in Georgia?
Yes.
And there is no Cochran firm office in Memphis?
Yes.
And you said to me, where did we go? Didn't we go to the Cochran firm office? And I said, yes, we did. And you were just quiet after that.
Yeah.
Tell us something about Larry Neal growing up. He was a smart boy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Tell us about it.
Well, he had off his own. He was very smart in a lot of ways. And then he was losing. He wouldn't be so smart in other ways. So he had that wealth and set up on the house in ice cold weather. All day that day I was at work. His dad was, he was at home with his grandma, and she said that he had set up on the house in ice cold weather all day long, had left school, and then stayed at school, come home and went up on the house and sat in that ice cold weather with the monks. And after that, he didn't do much good at all.
What kind of things would he do that were wrong?
Well, he turned the gas off one time in our house and sat behind the kitchen door. And he turned all the gas pipes off, the one in my bedroom, the one in the dining area, one in the kitchen, one in the bathroom. And I was noticing him because I knew he was off. And so he was turning all the gas off as he passed. All those heaters. I had to get up and turn the gas back off. You know, he turned them on. I had to turn them back off because he was blowing that gas. Then he sat behind the kitchen door in a straight chair for all of us to blow up together. He was blowing all of us to die together, blow up.
My goodness.
Uh-huh.
What about when he was a little boy? What did he do when he was a little boy that led to his going to Western State Hospital?
Well, being disobedient kind to dad and grandmama mostly, nailing at her while she was a witch.
Really?
Uh-huh.
He thought Mama was a witch.
Uh-huh. Because she's always sleeping the porch out with a broom and stuff like that.
I remember one time when he was a boy, when Larry was a boy, I remember him rigging a pan of water over the door so that when Mama walked through the door, when my grandmother walked through the door, the pan of water would fall on her. I remember when he was a little boy also that he was very smart, had never gone to electronics classes, but he took apart that big radio that Daddy had. He took it apart, and he had the floor filled with the parts of that radio. And Daddy came in and looked at him and said, boy, I want that radio back together, and it better work. And Larry put that radio back together, and it worked. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember getting taken. Make fire go loose. The fire is like laying this new family day tomorrow. And he took it. Somehow I know he checked something inside that she gave him that knocked him across the floor. And he had never bought no more electronics like.
So he touched a live wire.
Yeah, something inside that TV she had gave him. Because she knew he loved to mess with stuff like that. And she gave him one to take apart. or something inside that thing. Fold them on the holy books.
Now, Larry, at age 8 or 9, went to Western State Hospital for mental illness. Is that right?
Yes.
And they kept him until he was in his mid-20s. Is that right?
No, he was back in private home. Often. No, he don't run straight till I get him out of the coma, pick him up, keep him a while. I did. And then when he got bad again, I'd send him back. He went back in his bowels, I said.
So actually, the hospitals in those days didn't just get mentally ill people and throw away the key. They often sent them on home trial visits.
Yeah, uh-huh, sure did.
To see were they well enough to stay home, didn't they?
Uh-huh.
And Larry was never well enough to just stay home, was he?
No.
Would he stay on his medication when he came home?
No. He almost would jump on him when he tried to give him the pill sometimes. I even crumbled some up in some oil you try to see that he got his dose. And he looked like he was a fight.
That's what happens to a lot of mentally ill people, Mama. They don't want to stay on their medication when they get home. They feel stable, and they feel like they can do as well as anyone else, and they don't see where they're mentally ill, and so they refuse to take their medication, and then they start spiraling out of control, and they lose their grip on reality.
And you know, he tried to chuckle a jar of flour mixed with black pepper, somehow passed, fishing chicken, and burned it up. It just had a, just good he missed it, but he would kill him if he had hit him with that thing of flour.
So, because of your diligence, you were able to save your family many times from what you thought was possibly death. And you were also able to save your neighbors, weren't you? Do you feel like there were times when Larry was dangerous to neighbors?
Well, he's always going, Dr. Lord, go for secrets. But I don't know about being dangerous to them.
He wasn't dangerous to neighbors?
He was rushing today. He's up at 4 o'clock in the morning, knocking on their door looking for cigarettes.
That was very dangerous for him, wasn't it? Do you remember the time that Larry crawled in a neighbor's window to rock their baby that was crying?
He had a baby crying on the same street we lived on. And that baby continued to howl and cry. And he went in the house without notice to try to see about that baby and stop that baby from crying. That's because his mind wasn't good. He knew better than that.
He could have been killed for home invasion, couldn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when we made him a ward of the state, because you realized that you couldn't take care of Larry. Is that right?
Yes.
And so after that, we asked that he be made a ward of the state, and he went to live in a care home instead of living with you. Do you remember that?
No, I just know he was put in different care homes from place to place. And he didn't do well in this care home, they moved him to another.
Yes.
And he was always fighting and getting into it with the care home folks. Because they always wanted him to do some work. And he was a person that got sick, and he didn't want to do no kind of work. He didn't even want to have ashtrays. He just didn't want to do no work at all. And when he get up and dress, he didn't want to pick up his clothes. He didn't want to make up his bed. He didn't want to do nothing. And he would leave home without eating breakfast. He did his thing. It all did not have to do that. You have to leave her.
You know, Larry told me during one of my visits back to Memphis he was talking kind of off. And I asked him, Larry, did you have your medicine today before you left the care home? Because he would leave those care homes and go walking long distances. And I asked him, Larry, did you take your medicine before you left your care home today? And he told me, no, he leaves before they pass out the medicine. And that way he doesn't have to take it.
That way he used to do his videos. He left for his bed breakfast and he didn't get to eat.
He would go to Thomas's store most every morning and eat. And then he would...
The Belcher's Hospital.
Yes.
He'd go down to Belcher's Hospital and kiss it. And they would see it. And he'd go to somewhere else.
McDonald's?
Yeah, McDonald's. And they would give him something. They all knew him and they would see it.
So he was well known in that area of Memphis, wasn't he?
Uh-huh.
And he was well liked because he was really a loving person, wasn't he? You know, when we would give Larry money, he would quickly give it out to whoever. Here, you want a dollar?
Yeah. And give his secrets away.
His mind didn't really grow up after he was 8 years old with that mumps, did it, Mom?
No, it sure didn't. Sure didn't.
I remember when we were told that before Larry's fatal arrest, he was arrested when they took him, his social worker took him to the hospital for his blood pressure check because he had started having to take heart medicine before he died. Did you know that?
No.
He took high blood pressure medicine.
I don't know what he was taking, but he was away from me.
Well, he was taking high blood pressure medicine, heart medicine, and they took him for a checkup. And he said that the cuff that the woman put on his arm was too tight. And she kept tightening it, and he told her it was too tight. And then he spat on her like a little boy would because he was angry over her squeezing his arm with that cuff. He was arrested for that, but as usual, they released him. Larry was arrested lots of times, wasn't he?
Yeah. I think he was best for moving his ankle brace. I heard about that.
Did he get arrested even while you were living in Memphis with him?
Yeah.
So he would get arrested, and what would happen when he'd get arrested? Were there trials, or would they just release him to the family or his social worker?
Well, when he leaves the hospital without notice, I give a call to return him to the hospital because he had left. And I would have to get a name or somebody to take me, to take him back.
So he would leave the hospital without notice?
Uh-huh.
Which hospital was that?
Western State.
One time he jumped out of the window at Western State, didn't he?
Yeah, he wasn't trying to kill himself. He said he put something down to jump on. I don't know what it was, but he jumped out the window and broke up some parts of his body. That was something bad because he was in Jackson Mountain County Hospital for a while from hurting himself. From jumping out there, run that Russell Street.
After that, they put bars on those windows, didn't they?
I don't know.
I think they did. I remember when I was a little girl, we'd go visit Western State Hospital nearly every Sunday when Larry was in there. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember going there as I could.
And the hospital, you know, to me, it was like a big mansion. It was a great big red brick building with a beautiful lawn. Do you remember we would, if he had outside privileges, we would sit and visit with Larry on those lawn chairs.
Yeah.
And he talked to us about the craft classes they were taking, and they had social activities for the patients, didn't they?
Yeah. They had a little preaching class one time, and he graduated from that minister. He got about 3 or 4 books to come to my house where he had been finishing the ministry class.
Oh, so he took a ministry class while he was at the hospital.
Yeah, and he took music.
Oh, he did.
Uh-huh.
I know that he used to talk to us about the dances that they had and that the patients would try to, you know, be on their best behavior or they wouldn't get to attend the social event at the hospital.
I know. The doctor there told me he was unruly because he was supposed to dance with the same woman but one time. If he danced with her one time during the social, he was supposed to dance with that woman no more. He's supposed to pick somebody else. But he wouldn't go by the rules anyway. He just pick out one he liked and try to dance with her every time.
When Larry grew up, you know, after he was a grown man and he was refused to return to Western State Hospital, is that right? They wouldn't take him back.
I don't know.
Yes. They would not accept him back at Western State Hospital.
I know that was Andrew. They wouldn't accept back.
They said that a patient had to be a danger to himself and others, and that the people they had in Western State Hospital in those days were people who had done criminal offenses. And so they refused to accept him back as a inpatient at Western State Hospital, even though we were very worried about Larry being out in society in his mental condition. But they would accept him at Tennessee Psychiatric Hospital in Memphis, and he would stay usually short term just to get stabilized, maybe a week or two.
Yeah, they show it taking back there all the time when I can. Yeah, I can. And sometimes he'd be up there and upstairs at John Gassel Hospital. They had a billing place in there too. He'd be either there or at Tennessee Psychiatric Hospital. I took it both places.
Yes. And they would get him stabilized and then release him.
Uh-huh.
He was also treated in his home community, too, wasn't he?
Yes, at Dr. Boyce and Clinton.
When he was a little boy?
Uh-huh.
And when he grew up in Memphis, we moved to Memphis when he was in his 20s, he would get treatment in the community. Over there, I remember that community care clinic, they had certain days of the week at Melrose High School in Orange Mound. You remember that?
Yeah.
He would go over there and get treatment.
Uh-huh.
And one time he was at the clinic getting treatment, he met a woman. You remember that?
Yeah.
He came home and told us he had met a girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
What was her name?
I
think it was Shirley.
Shirley.
And so, generally speaking, though, when Larry was on his medication, he was calm and basically a happy person, wasn't he?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But usually he would decide to stop taking his medicines, wouldn't he?
Yeah. I know one time the little sister come in. She was going to law school. No, that's probably she was going to high school. But anyway, when she come in and put a book sign there at the bathroom door of the hood. And the door wasn't closed all the way. And she was in the hood to get to the bathroom because she just was coming away from school. And when she opened it, pushed the bathroom door all the way open so she could go in, he knocked her in the head with his fist. Said she was trying to see him naked. Well, that wasn't right. You know she wasn't trying to see him, but she was trying to get in the bathroom, and the door was open. She didn't know she had to knock or nothing. So he's always doing something like that.
Yes, that was frightening for you, for your mentally ill son to hit your baby girl, wasn't it?
Yeah, she just come in from school, and put a buckshot in there in front of the bathroom door. It was going to rush in there because she never heard him get to the bathroom. And he was back in there. And Doc turned ahead with his fist.
Yes. I remember sometimes when Larry would refuse to take his medicine and he was in a crisis, you would call other family members, your other sons, to come and try to convince him to take his medicine. You remember that? I remember one crisis when he was really slipping into psychosis and you called Bob to come and try to get him to take his medicine or to go with him to Tennessee Psychiatric. And that was a big controversy.
He throws Bob down on the floor.
You know, the thing is that what we're trying to get past now, Mama, is AOT programs, assisted outpatient treatment programs, so that people who have severe mental illness like Larry did, Larry had paranoid schizophrenia. We're trying to fix it so that people with his type of mental illness and other severe mental illnesses could be treated in outpatient treatment programs, which means that they wouldn't have to live in the hospital all the time. They would live in maybe care homes or maybe even at home with their families or by themselves. And they would receive housing assistance, that means rent, and food, and they'd also receive mandated psychiatric treatment. In other words, say, for instance, a social worker, if needed, would go by and give them their psychiatric drugs every day. And that way they'd stay on their treatment and they wouldn't ever get in a crisis. Do you think that's a good idea?
Excellent. Yes, I do.
That's what's needed, isn't it, Mama?
I believe so. I'm not sure, but I believe so.
You know, every one of the families that I talk to, and you hear me talking to them on the radio, every one of the families that I talk to look forward to AOT programs for their loved ones who have mental illness. Did you know about that?
I heard about it, yeah.
And another thing that we look forward to is crisis intervention team training. And that is police officers sometimes are not really trained to help people with mental illness. And when they go to pick up the mentally ill, they are sometimes afraid of them. And so many mentally ill people have been killed by police. Have you heard of some of those cases?
Yeah, I heard of them.
Now, Larry grew up in a small town, and generally speaking, the police officers in our town, they all knew that Larry Neal was mentally ill. And so they would come and they would arrest him without harming him, wouldn't they? But the people now live in these big metropolitan areas. The police don't know what kind of circumstance they're being called into, and they're afraid of the person, and so often they kill them or they seriously hurt them on their lunacy arrest. So what crisis intervention team training would do is it would train police officers how to deal with mentally ill people. Do you think that's a good idea? Because, you know, a lot of times people have not ever been around anyone with mental illness, you know, and they don't know what to expect. They're afraid and they react. They overreact. I read recently about a little white girl, 19 years old in California, who her family called the police for intervention. And the police officers killed her when they got there. Isn't that sad?
Yes, boy.
We have a caller that we'll allow to speak right now and see what they have to say about this. Hello, caller at 7892. How are you?
How are you, Marius Gloria?
Hello, Gloria. How are you? Were you listening to my mom? Were you listening to my mother?
I just got on. I just came in from visiting a person in a long-term facility. So,
well, this is my mother, Hattie Neal. Mama, this is Miss Gloria. She's a mental health advocate.
Hi, Hattie.
Hi, Gloria.
How are you?
How are you?
Okay. Hi.
Mama Gloria has two children who are grown now, but they had mental illness growing up.
Yeah.
And so she became a mental health advocate like you and I are now. And she had a lot of difficulty with police officers and what have you, but they're grown up now and they're doing well, aren't they, Gloria?
Oh, yeah. One's going to become a police officer, believe it or not, and help kids. So there you have it. She'll be one of the good ones, I guess.
Well, we need good police officers, and we have some. We
right.
have some good police officers, and we need more. And, you know,
right.
sometimes I get so upset because it seems like, you know, every report about police officers seems to be negative, when the truth is that that might push away good people who decide to go into policing because the whole profession gets a bad reputation from the bad ones that we have. But we
right.
do have some bad ones, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yeah, and there were quite a few detectives and not in the state of Rhode Island that helped me that were in the state of Connecticut that helped me with my kids. So, I mean, there were that, and one is because was sort of like what, why my daughter's becoming a police officer, because his evaluation process was kind, and he gave you a break, and he said, if you can't handle it, you come back tomorrow, and, you know, and it was kind, compassion, and this guy had it going on, but
well,
a lot
see,
of them are like,
important.
Kindness right.
and compassion, you know, the thing is, though, that when police officers are called into a crisis situation involving a mentally ill person, they sometimes just react because they haven't got that kindness and that compassion.
They don't have
and
the training, Mary.
They don't have the training.
No.
And some
they
of them...
They don't go through any psychological. They don't even take any psychology courses. The street, you know, cops, like the cops in the car, and they can get out of high school and just go to the academy, and that's it. They don't take, like, you know, 4 years of college and psychology courses and behavioral courses and how is this person going to react, what do they, you know, they get crash courses. And, you know, some of the, and I'm not saying anything bad, but I've worked with a mentally ill for probably 4 years. Some of people with mental illness do look scary. So if you're not trained, you don't know what to look for. You don't know the body movements. You don't know how to interact whatsoever. Probably the police officers are scared to death themselves. You know?
They are,
they don't
Gloria.
Understand.
They really are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's understandable. I'm
right.
going to let someone else speak for a moment. Would you please stay on the line, Gloria?
Of course.
Thank you. All right. We have a caller at 0399-0399. Oh, they don't want 0399 to speak. Let me try to let you in. 0399, how are you today?
I am fine, bless.
Oh, is this Miss Olga?
Yes, ma'am. This is Miss Garcia speaking.
Oh, wonderful, Miss Olga Garcia, Mama.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
That's my mother, Miss Olga Garcia.
Hello.
Oh, that's your mama. Hello, how you doing? Nice to meet you on the radio.
Well, I'm glad to meet you, too.
Miss Olga
God
Garcia.
Bless you, ma'am.
Miss Olga Garcia is one of the people we help at Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill. Her son is in jail for mental illness.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Olga, Mama said
yes,
she's
ma'am.
Sorry,
I'm sorry.
Your
I couldn't
son
hear
is
her
arrested
good.
For mental illness.
Uh-huh.
I want you to know, Ms. Olga, that I completed an article.
Yes, I just saw that. Yes. Praise Jesus.
And I explained to the public how he killed the police officer.
Yes.
That he was arrested for 14 days, and police who had him under arrest refused to give him his psychiatric treatment the whole time he was arrested, 2 weeks.
Yes.
And how the other inmates reported that he begged for his drugs. And they refused to give him his psychiatric treatment. And by the time the 14th day rolled around, he also was reportedly beaten by police. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. He was. He was deprived of the meds and he was beaten. He was crying for help. Nobody helped him. 19 witnesses wrote to Channel 13 here in Houston, Texas. And still no prevail. No help. And ends up now with a 40-year sentence and still getting mentally and physically tortured and verbally abused.
We're so sorry about that. Mama, Ms. Garcia is going to be one of our claimants. U.S. Amy, A-I-M-I, that's for assistance to the incarcerated mentally ill, versus USA. We're taking the treatment of the mentally ill in America before the international court. Because we feel like the international court, they'll get a more fair hearing than they get in American courts. Because her son did something wrong. And the reason he did it is because they wouldn't give him his treatment while he was in jail. And then they beat him before they released him. So he was hurting both physically and mentally the day they let him out of jail. And when his mother called police and police came, her son had a gun that he had been able to buy illegally. He bought it legally from a gun dealer. He bought it legally. They evidently didn't do a background check on him. And his son had a gun, and when the police were standing there in the door, when the door opened, the police were standing there, and her son shot the police officer. So these are the tragedies that happen when mentally ill people are deprived of their treatment, when they're arrested among people who don't seem to care about them or care about justice or fairness, withhold their treatment. Sometimes they get killed, and other times they may become killers. How do you feel about that?
I feel terrible.
It is, isn't it? It is terrible how the mentally ill are deliberately deprived of treatment and then they become killers because of that deprivation of psychiatric treatment. Excuse me, I should have turned the phone off before I got started talking to you. I'm sorry. I'll turn it off now. In any case, that's what happens when treatment is denied. People who have serious mental illness go into crises, and that puts the entire community at risk. That puts their families at risk if they have some of the more severe types of mental illness like paranoid schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe depression. The rule is that you can't get mandatory treatment. You can't get treatment that they have not agreed to unless they've already proved to be a danger to self and others. Let me ask you, Gloria, how much of a problem is that rule that a family cannot commit a person until they've already proved to be a danger to self and others? How detrimental is that rule?
Well, that's awful because some of the some of the psychiatric drugs that these psychiatrists put people on have side effects of suicidal ideation and homicidal ideation. That's before they're even on them. And it's just when they don't have a choice. They don't have the cognitive skills, a person with mental illness, to say that they're sick. They don't even think they're, you know, having a problem. And it's so hard because they're an adult, and that's what happens to these kids, and I saw it time and time, in and out, in and out. I worked at a psychiatric facility where there was a child psychiatrist, and these kids age 6, 7, 8 are put on Adderall. When they become 18 years old, they don't have to take that medication anymore. You can't force an 18-year-old, so now they're out on the streets. You take that Band-Aid off. They're not taking their medication. The parents are struggling, and they become violent. These kids become violent, and they don't even know they're violent.
Well, you know, the situation you just described, Gloria, is what happened at Virginia Tech when this young man was a student there. His parents had had him on psychiatric medication for years. But when he was 17, he decided to stop taking it. And his parents went for help to get him to stay on his medication. But the system refused because they said that he was too near age 18. And once he got 18, his parents wouldn't have any more control over him taking the drugs anyway. And so they wouldn't help his parents keep him on his psychiatric treatment. And eventually, as a young college student, this young man shot 32 people and himself. He killed, as I understand it, 32 people. And that is because of the sudden cessation of his psychiatric treatment. Do you recall that Virginia Tech massacre?
Yes. Well,
it
there was
very
one
sad.
Real close in Middletown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook.
Was that young man on psychiatric treatment?
Yes, yeah. And you know who I blame are the psychiatrists that don't get involved. The ones that are giving the medication to these kids, that they have to be followed. They have to be monitored. If you're giving a psychotropic drug that has homicidal, suicidal ideation when you're on it, okay, they have to be monitored. They should be going back once a month and also in therapy. So there's two
people.
Well,
you know, the problem with that, Gloria, is that the government, which is full of prison investors, by the way, they have the rules. The psychiatrists don't have the right to enforce treatment. If that person has decided to stop their treatment, there is nothing their parents can do. There's nothing there. Care homes, many psychiatric patients live in care homes. There's nothing the care home administrators can do. There's nothing that anyone can do to enforce a psychiatric patient who's not in a hospital to continue their treatment. And there are people who are in psychiatric, they're advocates for psychiatric patients. They don't want us to be able to enforce treatment. They're against AOT programs where mandated treatment is available. They're against them because they're more for the patient's rights. And they say that it would be a violation of these psychiatric patients' rights if they have to stay on their treatment outside of a mental hospital or a jail. But they're nowhere around when these people shoot people. They're nowhere around when these psychiatric patients go into crisis. They are nowhere around when these same psychiatric patients are standing up in front of a judge and jury. They are nowhere around these people who are against mandated treatment are nowhere to be found when the results of the lack of treatment lead so many people into incarceration. 1.25 million people so far. What do you say about that? Do you feel, Ms. Olga Garcia, that your son is in jail today because of his deprivation of psychiatric treatment. Do you feel that if they had given your son the medicines that he was begging for, that Officer Hamilton would be alive?
Yes, ma'am. I don't feel, I know that they would have given him his medication, and if Academy wouldn't have sold him a legal gun, the officer would have his life right now, and my son would also have his life back. Exactly. But see, these people were aware he was sick. I mean, any person with common sense, if the man is begging, you know he's got a problem, and you're depriving him of the meds, that's wanting to make somebody do something, wanting him to kill or to do whatever, giving him a gun. You know, so they played a major role in this tragedy. Harris County Academy, the city of Pasadena for I dispatched, called 911. I got to tell the officer, he's got a gun now, sir. My boy put the gun on me, on his own mother, that he loves dearly. You think him in his right mind would do something like that? If he would have been in his right mind, and if he was going to kill somebody, he would have gone and killed the police officer that in 2006, they beat the living life out of him. There's a video to prove it. For imbalance, as this lady was saying, I think she said she worked at a hospital or something. The psychiatrist put him on meds. I mean, there's a lot of side effects. That's why at this point right now, I'm trying to find out who changed my son's medication, who, why, and what, because there is a lot of side effects. Sometimes instead of some of it helping you, they have suicidal. It's just all kinds of meds that have different side effects, and that's where I'm at right now, that they change the meds without me knowing what kind it is, and then I call up there to talk to the psychologist, and they don't want to give me an email. Nobody wants to give me an email for what we talked about. So, I mean, it's like you say, it's prison investors. It's all about the money. It's all about the more mentally ill people we have in prison, the more money they're making. And it needs to stop. We need to fight. We need to have laws. I wish there was more people that would be in agreement in the name of Jesus to fight for the rights of the mentally ill who are incarcerated, who are deprived. There's still some out there still being deprived of their meds and being abused and psychologically and the whole scenario of all the things that torture, that deteriorate more the brain. Because it when you have trauma to the brain, mind you, right now my son has a bullet lodged in his ear. They shot him too. It's not like they didn't shoot.
They shot your son also.
Yes.
Well, you know, Ms. Garcia is describing to you what happened when the police officer came to her house to arrest her son because the family had called police when he showed up in psychiatric crisis after 14 days of incarceration, being denied his treatment. He begged for his treatment, and they refused to give him his psychiatric treatment. Plus, he experienced a police beating before his release from incarceration. And so Sergio Robles was in psychological and physical pain by the time he was released from the jail, where he served 14 days for DUI, deprived of his drugs, his psychiatric medication. And so he was in crisis, and they turned him loose that way. But this time it backfired, and the police department lost one of their own. Let me ask you, as a mental health advocate, I know that you are a certified mental health advocate, Ms. Gloria. Was the jail, Harris County Jail in Texas, were they supposed to give Mr. Robles that was on mental health drugs, were they supposed to administer his drugs while he was incarcerated for DUI for 14 days and he asked them for his treatment?
Well, some of the smaller jails, they hold them and then release them. They don't have, you know, I know in Rhode Island they have a department where they hold people when they need to be arraigned or whatnot. And they have a doctor there. They have a nurse there, and it's a bigger facility. And I don't understand why he wasn't transferred. If he was being held for 14 days, he should not have been in that little local county jail or whatever where there was not a doctor. He should have been overseen.
He should have been transferred to a larger facility that was equipped to handle severe mental patients.
Yes.
Well, you know, they already also knew that this young man was mentally ill because, as a matter of fact, they had paid out over $150,000 when 3 years before that, when he had heard that his father died. He went into a psychiatric crisis. He was walking down the middle of the street, and the police stopped, and they stopped him. He was in a psychiatric crisis. He was very grief-stricken, and they beat him half to death. And eventually, they had to pay out $125,000 or $150,000 for that beating that they did on this mentally ill young man. That was Sergio Robles. So they already knew he was a severe mental patient. They had record of that previous beatdown, and they had record of their lawsuit they had had to pay for that beatdown. And for all we know, that could have been why Sergio was treated the way he was during his last incarceration before he killed the police officer. Do you think that had anything to do with them denying him his medication, Ms. Garcia? Do you think they were retaliating?
Yes. Exactly. Now with everything, the whole scenario and everything I've experienced and observed and everything, yes. And first of all, I live in Houston, Texas is the fourth largest city in the state of Texas. And you mean to tell me they couldn't put him in a where they were supposed to know? They knew. It was the fourth. It's the fourth largest city. It wasn't in a little county. It was in Harris County, which is a big city. So that there, it all comes down to retaliation, discrimination. When they first beat him up in 2006, that was discrimination. That was, even the attorney said, you will not win because your son's got tattoos, he's a Hispanic, and there's nothing but Anglo people there. Rednecks, Anglo, those were his words. He didn't even want to help me to fight it. So it all boils down to retaliation and discrimination. And they knew he was mentally ill because on the first tragedy, I told the officer, I got to talk to him on the phone, and I said, please don't shoot my son. He's mentally ill. He just lost his father. So all the times, they were aware of what they were dealing with.
They were aware of what they were dealing with. Well, that's the same situation that happened to Larry Neal. He was secretly arrested after that last arrest that I told you about, when he was arrested for his cuff being tightened on his arm and he spat on the healthcare provider. He was arrested then for assault, but they only kept him a short time, and then he was released, as I understand it, to his social worker. And he was taken in for psychological evaluation and released. That happened only a couple of weeks before his fatal arrest. And we feel like Memphis Shelby County Police retaliated against Larry Neal. He was secretly arrested. He was kept 18 days while the police denied having him incarcerated. And we don't know what happened to Larry during that 18 days. We don't know whether he was beaten, tasered, starved. We've heard about cases where mentally ill people were starved to death. We don't know what was happening to Larry Neal during those 18 days of secret incarceration. But they kept him that long, ignoring his missing person report, lying to his family, lying to his social worker, denying that he was incarcerated in Memphis Shelby County Jail for nearly 3 weeks, until finally police came and knocked on the door where other relatives live now, where his mother used to live, and they said, "We have Larry Neal's body. He's dead. He died this morning." That was on August 1st, 2003. And they will not answer how they killed him. They will not release any of the records of his fatal arrest. It is a complete secret. As a matter of fact, when I wrote the U.S. DOJ and asked under the Freedom of Information Act for his fatal arrest records, I was told that they refused to release them because it's a matter of national security. What on earth could be done to a black, handicapped, mentally ill American, an American with a disability, that would make it a matter of national security? I tell you, I think that they made it a national security risk when they secretly arrested this young man. Well, he wasn't so young. He was 54, harmless, mentally ill. They had a long history of dealing with him. They had a long history of arrest for things like singing loud outside, panhandling. They had a long history of arrest for that. They knew about his psychiatric condition. They ignored a missing person report. They ignored or lied to everyone who called the jail about him and disclaimed having him in custody. They made it a national security risk because Larry Neal's death seems to have been a premeditated, cold-blooded murder. When you take a person who's on psychiatric drugs and heart medication, and you deprive them of receiving heart medication, then you put them at risk of death. All heart medication has a warning label on it that says sudden cessation of taking this medication can be fatal. If you're on heart medication and you suddenly are deprived of it, your heart, which has been regulated for years in Larry's case by that heart medication, to be deprived of it during a secret arrest is a death sentence. Also, Larry's death certificate said he died of heart trouble, heart attack. We know that when medical examiners don't want to write that a person was tasered to death, they just write heart attack, because that's what tasers can cause, particularly people with bad hearts. We know that Larry's medical examiner was O.C. Smith's office. O.C. Smith is the same medical examiner who, according to federal records, was actually preparing to go on trial for wrapping barbed wire around his own head, taping himself with duct tape, and hiding himself in the stairwell of the Memphis Shelby County Medical Examiner's office to pretend to be kidnapped. And O.C. Smith had allegedly written notes and taped them to himself with the duct tape that said, "O.C. Smith lied. O.C. Smith lied about the bullet trajectory in the Philip Wood case." I believe it's Philip Wood. I'll look that up for you. Philip Wood was a white man who was facing the death penalty for killing a police officer after he tried to rob a Wendy's. This man ran from police, and he said, hiding underneath a car when he saw the police officer who chased him get shot. That's what Philip Wood described. But he himself was charged with shooting that police officer, and he himself was on the death row for shooting the police officer. I found out later through communication with a former Memphis police guard that police officer who was shot, that was his first week back on street duty after being on in-house duty for some time because he had allegedly broken the picket line. The police evidently had picketed and were on strike in Memphis. And he, this officer who was killed, had broken the picket line, had worked during that period. And it was said that the other police officers had great animosity toward him. And so he was taken to work in-house in the jail for a long period of time after the strike ended. But this was his first week back on duty, and he came up dead. And Philip Wood, if I'm pronouncing his name right, was charged with his death, but he said he did not shoot him, that another police officer shot the man, the police officer who died, the one who had broken the picket line. So years later, when it was almost time for Philip to be executed, the medical examiner who had been the star witness in this man's trial said himself that the bullet trajectory did not come from the direction that the medical examiner, O.C. Smith, had said. According to the records, O.C. Smith himself kidnapped himself. He staged a kidnapping because he wanted to throw questions on his own testimony as it came time to kill this man. He himself, according to this information, accused himself of lying at this man's capital murder trial and saying that the bullet trajectory came from his direction when in fact it did not. So this same medical examiner is the medical examiner who, that's the same one who was the medical examiner when Larry Neal died. It would appear that O.C. Smith was a man who would bend the truth to protect police officers. It would appear that he was a person who would bend the truth to protect police officers. The medical examiner in Memphis works for the same party as the police. They all work for Shelby County, as I understand it. And so he simply wrote, or his office simply wrote about Larry Neal's autopsy, that he died a heart attack, and we got no information, no inquest, no investigation whatsoever about what brought on the heart attack. Was it deprivation of his heart drugs only, or was it also tasering? Was there a scuffle with police officers or other inmates? What brought on this heart attack? What brought it on? Was he in a restraint chair? Was he killed in a restraint chair, which also would bring on a heart attack to a weak patient? How did Larry Neal die, and why is that a secret 11 years later? Why is that a secret? Why can't we know how my brother died? Why is the government, why is Shelby County government, why are the media companies, why are local officials here in Georgia, why are they all in on hiding the methodology of Larry Neal's murder? And they're all in on it. They won't publish anything about it. The media here in Georgia would not even publish when the Johnny Cochran firm went to court and denied having an office in Georgia, denied having a Cochran firm office in Georgia. That is a major news story, that a big plaintiff's law firm went to court and denied having its office in Georgia, denied any affiliation with the Cochran firm office in Georgia, denied it. That's outright perjury. You can look online at their own website, the Cochran firm, and look for its list of offices, and Atlanta is listed first when it's alphabetically ordered. The judges agreed with the Cochran firm and dismissed our lawsuit because the main thing was to never let it be known publicly that the Cochran firm was working in the interest of the U.S. DOJ, which allowed Memphis Shelby County Jail to give it erroneous, false, fraudulent information when it had those release hearings for Shelby County Jail. I say to you that this justice system in America is crooked from the top to the bottom. We depend on the Justice Department to protect the rights of institutionalized people like Larry Neal was and like Mr. Robles was and like many, many other mentally ill people are and were, like Darren Rainey was, like Jerome Murdaugh was, like Mr. Embry, who starved to death in Kentucky State Prison, was. We depend on the USDOJ to protect the rights of institutionalized people, but they won't do it. They won't even investigate these deaths. Lord, have mercy on hypocrites in government. Lord, have mercy on people who must depend on hypocrisy to protect the rights of their handicapped loved ones. Lord, have mercy. Jesus Christ sits high on his throne. And the Bible says that the Lord sits high and he listens to the groaning of the prisoner and to all who are appointed to destruction. And I thank God for listening to the prisoners, the ones who are hurting today, the ones who are in solitary confinement, and they won't let them hear from or see their parents. They can't even visit their children who are isolated in solitary confinement, taking what little is left of their minds, Lord. These people are evil and destructive. And I thank God that you said, such as you do unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you do also unto me. That said that Jesus Christ, whom obviously these people do not believe in, but one day he's going to split the sky and return, and then you will see what I know, and that is that God does not like ugly. God does not like ugly. Meanwhile, whether or not you are a Christian, we have the United States Constitution that you're violating when you deprive people who are mentally ill of fair, open public trials with adequate defense appointed. You violate the U.S. Constitution when you do these backdoor executions like Larry Neal got. He wasn't charged with any capital offense, but he was executed at the back door. Many, many mentally ill people are executed through the back door. You violate the International Declaration of Human Rights when you do these offenses against mentally ill people and their families, because we know that you want Americans to be quiet about these crimes against humanity that are continuous and constant in America. And that is why we recognize these things and we are taking these matters before the International Court in an action called AIMI, A-I-M-I, versus USA. And we're filing in 2015 because the United Nations must not only be used to bomb other countries for so-called humanitarian purposes, but the United Nations must be obeyed by its member nations when it says that nobody should be in solitary confinement for over 15 days. The United Nations must be obeyed when it says that people must have freedom of speech, and freedom of press. And so should the U.S. Constitution be obeyed. So should U.S. code be obeyed when it says nobody shall be persecuted when they do anything that is a constitutionally protected activity. Suing after wrongful death is a constitutionally protected activity, but I have experienced persecution, censorship, stalking, because I make it people aware of how my brother was treated, and I make people aware of how millions of other people are treated. Look at Dog Justice for Mentally Ill to meet some of the claimants under Amy versus USA. Read about some of those people who will be going before the International Court for relief for their loved ones or for restitution for their wrongful deaths. We will press for restitution not only for mentally ill people who were deprived of treatment, like Ms. Garcia's son, but also people like his victim, the police officer who would not be dead if he had been treated for his mental illness as he should have been. So we are taking this thing to international court, and we're asking you to pray for us, Amy versus USA, because many lives could be saved if treatment replaces punishment in the USA. But punishment is the only way for prison investors to get their stock dividends. That is why people with severe mental illness are preserved untreated until they hurt someone. They even say you must prove to be a danger to self or others before you are treated without your agreement. That is a death sentence to many people. It's been a death sentence for many people, including the mentally ill themselves, because most often they are not violent, but they're perceived to be a danger, and police simply kill them on sight. I said police simply kill them on sight. Other times they're arrested and prison guards kill them because there's no accountability. There's no accountability for the deaths of mentally ill people in America usually. And when they are called into account for such deaths, as the people who killed Kelly Thomas were, they were called into account. Two of the officers, there were six, but two of them were called into account for his murder. But even then, they were released without any punishment. The jury released them. And so we just really thank you for caring about the mentally ill. We thank you for coming and joining us today. I'm going to let my mother tell you thank you and what she thinks about the work we're doing so far. I appreciate everyone who works with Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill, because we're working together not only to gain restitution for things that have happened to our families that should not have happened, but also we're working for change in how America responds to mental illness. I wouldn't want to conclude without mentioning an important congressional bill to you, and that is H.R. 3717. That's a mental health bill by Representative Tim Murphy out of Pennsylvania. And I tell you, Pennsylvania is one of the worst abusers of mentally ill people that I know about. Representative Tim Murphy is a congressman out of Pennsylvania, and he has before Congress right now a mental health bill called H.R. 3717. It has provisions for some of the changes that need to be made. We talked in this program about assisted outpatient treatment programs, AOT programs. You heard my mother say that that seems to be what's needed for people with severe mental illness. We also talked about the need for CIT training for police officers. That's crisis intervention team training to get more police officers who are doing these lunacy arrests familiar with mental illness so that they don't just react when they meet a person who's looking, as Ms. Gloria said, looking scary, acting scary, but not necessarily a threat. And it also provides for crisis intervention training for some of the officers who work inside of jails, the corrections officers. If those people in the jail where Mr. Robles was, if they had recognized how important it was for him to stay on his psychiatric drugs, They either should have administered his psychiatric medications or they should have transferred him, as Ms. Gloria said, to a larger facility that had the ability to administer his drugs. He should not, with his severe mental illness that the police well knew about, because they had to pay out a lawsuit for beating him during a crisis 3 years before. If they had recognized the importance of his psychiatric medication, which he begged for, perhaps Officer Hamilton would have been alive today and Mr. Robles would have finished his barbering school training. He had a lovely young lady he was in love with and had a new baby, and he hadn't had a psychiatric crisis in years, but they sent him into one. And that was wrong. That was wrong. There are many wrong things happening. I want to let you know about Mr. Fred Hayes, who has not been allowed to see his son, Damian Hayes, for 3 years. When families are not allowed to see their mentally ill loved ones who are wrongly incarcerated rather than in hospitals, then they don't even know if they're still alive. I told you during this broadcast about two men who were killed in custody. One, that they did not report his death from San Carlos prison for 17 months. And one was my brother, who they secretly arrested. He was not in jail. They secretly arrested him and denied having him for 18 days while they did heaven knows what to him. Medical experiments, removing organs. We don't know what they were doing to Larry Neal during those 18 days of secret incarceration, because the government, neither the Shelby County government in Tennessee or the USDOJ, the United States government, will let us know what they did to Larry Neal during those 18 days of secret incarceration in the United States of America, the humanitarian country, the country where humanitarian concerns are placed above other concerns, domestic concerns, humanitarian concerns that happen in other countries, are placed above things that the budget could be spent for here. But this is the inhumane way my mother is treated, not knowing how you killed Larry Neal. Not knowing. She's 91 now, and she would like for you to say how he died. We'd like to know. Mama, would you like to know how Larry Neal died?
Yes.
Would you like to know that? Let them know that you would like to know.
Yes, I would like to know. What killed him? How he died? Did he get food? Did he have a doctor? Did his nose get transferred to the jail? How did he die? I wish I didn't know.
You dreamed of different ways he could have died, haven't you?
Yes. I don't know how he died.
They won't tell us. Do you think that's fair?
No.
Do you think it's because we're black people?
I don't know.
But it's wrong for a government to arrest a man and not even tell his elderly mother how he died, isn't it?
Yes.
So, there you have it. And I want to thank you for joining us today. I want you to look online for Amy versus USA. And that's AIMI versus USA. I'm going to give Ms. Gloria and then Ms. Garcia a final word, and we will say goodbye to you after that. Ms. Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today. You heard my mother ask how her son died. Do you think she should have a right to know?
Yes, I do. And God bless both of you. And it's a horrific thing when your son or loved one dies and you don't know how they died. But thy will be done, Mary. Thy will be done.
It's wrong, Miss Gloria. My mother
yes.
has had nightmares about the different scenarios under which Larry Neal may have expired. But this government and Shelby County government refused her the information that she needs for closure. You know, when Michael Vick was accused of killing dogs, their deaths were investigated thoroughly, and Michael Vick had to pay the penalty for those dogs dying. But my brother was not a dog. He was a man. And his death has not been investigated, and neither has anyone had to give an account, much less pay a penalty for his death. I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong for America. I think it's wrong for our Americans with disabilities. And I think that it is a shame on any country to arrest a handicapped person and then keep them 18 days under secret incarceration, kill them, and refuse the family any word of how that individual died. Refuse the family any closure. But to go to great lengths to make sure that people who kill dogs pay a penalty for that, I think that's wrong. How do you feel about it, Ms. Olga Garcia?
I don't feel. I know it's wrong, and they know it's wrong. But like I said, it happens. It continues happening. But we need to keep in prayer and be in agreement. And the Lord is going to do justice because He said it, and He's going to do it. And the vengeance are not going to be ours. We're going to let the Lord Jesus Christ do it. And I know your mother is a mother of the Lord. I feel her pain because I go through this. The only thing is, I know the Lord has my son alive, and I can still see him. But I'm still deprived of having contact visit with him. They're, like you were saying, they put him in solitary, and it's been three years that I haven't been able to hug my son either. So I feel your mama's pain, and I pray that the Lord is going to do justice in His time, and He's doing it because He's bringing all the darkness into light. And we just got to continue agreeing and praying, and the truth will set them free, and it's going to come out. It's coming out. It's the Lord's already doing what He said He was going to do. And my thing, I asked for help. I asked for CIT training officers. I took the means and measures to try to prevent a tragedy. But what happened? They wanted this to happen. They wanted to kill. They wanted to lock my son up and put him in prison. They said they were going to put him in a hospital, and that's not so. My son is in prison right now. He's not in a hospital the way the judge ordered it was going to be. So let's just continue praying for our nations and authority that the Lord touch their hearts to do just start coming forward, because the justice system is corrupted. It's all corrupted, and it's all about money. If you got money, they buy you out.
Well, you are so right, Garcia. We are ruled over by people who are prison investors. And I tell you something, that conflict of interest, having prison investors make decisions regarding law and punishment, crime and punishment, is the biggest mistake this country ever made. Prison investors, that is an automatic conflict of interest. That prison investors are making laws. They're deciding what laws shall be. They're deciding what punishments shall be in place. And they're pushing for the lengthiest punishments possible. They're pushing for laws that are deliberately on their face racist, like the 100-to-1 crack to cocaine, powder cocaine law. They're pushing for three strikes laws, law of parties. These same people who own prison stocks are the ones who push for those types of harsh sentencing laws. And they've decided to use America's people with mental illness to line their pockets. They've decided to withhold treatment until these mentally ill people whose parents take them, whose family members or close friends take them and say, help him. He's sick. He's off his meds. Help him get back on track. And they laugh at them and say, not unless he proves to be a danger to self and others. That is deliberate. As a matter of fact, I talked to one mother whose son committed suicide because he'd rather commit suicide than to do what those voices in his head told him to do. And before he committed suicide, she had taken him to the hospital where he had been released from. And she told them that he was in crisis. And the hospital refused her, just as they refused Senator D's son, Gus. They refused her. And she saw when the hospital worker got up from her desk, she looked at her son's chart, and she saw written there that he's in crisis now. It's only a matter of time before he breaks the law to allow arrest. She saw that written on his chart, that the hospital worker that she was begging and pleading for space in that hospital to get her son back balanced had written down that he's in crisis and it's only a matter of time before he does something worthy of arrest. I told the lawyer that I recommended for her. So even some hospitals are in on this prison profiteering game. And it's evil. It's evil to the taxpayers. When they say to you that they cannot help your relative unless he proves to be a danger to self and others, I want to remind every taxpayer listening that you are the potential others. You are the potential others. You shop at the same malls. You drive down the same streets. You go to the same schools as people who've been refused treatment until they prove to be a danger to self and others. So let's overcome what's going on with these prison investors. Let's change how mental health treatment is given in this country. Let's stand behind H.R. 3717, and please stand behind Amy versus USA. Thank you very much for joining us today. Please share this tape, and may God bless you. May God keep you. May God shine his grace upon you. May God send our government leaders righteous advisors.
The whole round world will hear.